you to take us to a WNBA game.
Yeah, well, nachos are nachos.
Let's go.
We keep things rolling here on The Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado, and it was a very jam-packed, fun sports weekend. Hopefully, you each had a wonderful Easter weekend if you celebrate. If you don't, hopefully, you had yourself a wonderful weekend nonetheless. And all the different holidays coming up, we hope you enjoy safe and sound. And one of the main dishes, the main course in our sports weekend full of meals was the matchup we had all been looking forward to, the Iowa Hawkeyes, the LSU Tigers in the Elite Eight to get to the Final Four. For Angel Reese versus Caitlin Clark, everything going on with Kim Mulkey, and it delivered, friends. It delivered big time. This matchup, this storyline, everything that was promised between a matchup of two great athletes with some awesome other stars surrounding those two great athletes and a head basketball coach in Kim Mulkey, who I have my own opinions on. I don't necessarily like off the court, but on the court, a heck of a coach, made some mistakes in this game against Caitlin Clark, who just went off, and we'll get into all that in just a second, but an unfortunate injury, or what seems to be an injury that changed the dynamic of this matchup for Angel Reese, and Caitlin Clark stepping up and having that moment, that it moment, the I'm not only here, I'm the person. And shout out to that game, it lived up to everything. A little bit more in detail, it was a win for the Iowa Hawkeyes, 94-87. Angel Reese, 36 minutes, 20 rebounds, 4 assists with 17 points, and for Caitlin Clark, a 40-minute effort with 7 rebounds, 12 assists, and 41 points. I'm not going to stay here and pretend and break down that I know women's college basketball. I don't watch the sport enough. I appreciate it. I love the athletes. I love how much the sport has grown and how much it has become part of the sports lexicon, that has become part of the sports conversation. It is part of the water cooler talk. It is part of the text chain. It is a part of social media banter. It's at the barbershops. It is a testament to how much the sport, the athletes have grown, the personalities have grown. And I'm not going to pretend, though, that I watch day in and day out in November, December, January, February. I don't. But the stars are so big, like Angel Reese, like Caitlin Clark, like some of these other awesome players like Juju we saw for USC and we're seeing for UConn with some of the buckets. Like, there's a lot of great players out there that are entertaining and are moving this thing forward from some of the greats that we've seen before, like Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird and Candace Parker and just everybody, all the greats, right? But again, I'm not going to sit here like I watch it the same way I watch the NBA, the NFL, MLB, but I can tell you this, and without BSing, talking about stats and matchups and what Kim Mulkey should have done beyond on just either switching who she had defended with Caitlin Clark or double teaming her, I can tell you this much about sports. The crossover has happened. The momentum has shifted. It is now big time. It's always big time. Nobody needs me to declare it anything. But if I'm here realizing it, if I can see it, a dum-dum like me, women's college basketball is here. And whether it translates to the same type of level in the WNBA and the WNBA takes its next step, which in itself, the W has done a great job in having awesome ratings, going to get their own TV deal, and shout out to them, but the growth is happening. And I think what you're seeing is a healthy women's college basketball that is going to help flourish national basketball in the WNBA, where they don't have to play international ball. They can make a lot of money here. The sport's only going to get better. The stars are only going to get better. They're going to be even bigger personalities. And I want to get into this as well. And I think it's something you can't ignore. This matchup between Iowa and LSU, between the greatness of Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, who's a national champion, right? Beat these Hawkeyes. It's important to bring up that there was a lot of nuance in this matchup. There was a lot of underlying conversations and tensions, not necessarily on the court, even though some of it was there, not necessarily on the bench, even though some of it was there, not necessarily all the time on the media, which a lot of it was there, but in general, in the sports conversation, especially when it becomes a national conversation with people who aren't watching every single game, that don't watch sports, but are only here for the big stories that cross into real world stuff. This had to deal with race. This had to deal with location and region of the country. This had to do with politics. This had to do with coaching and the way coaches present themselves and the power that they have. And while to a lot of people, That is just crazy. And how is this possible? How did this all happen? And, you know, it's a blemish on the sport. And also, how can you enjoy it? And why does it have to be so serious? And all the different conversations you had to justify, all these different avenues people took to talk about this matchup from last year's national championship to this matchup to get to the Final Four, all while valid, bringing up the race issue, bringing up women in sports, their equality, what they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, like we heard Angel Reese talk about, being scrutinized, being judged, being all the different things you can think of. And to be honest with you, the one thing I see in it is a weirdness in a weird schadenfreude type of way. It's progress, because we're no longer talking about, look at what the women are doing. Look what the girls are doing. Can you believe the girls are doing this? We're talking about the things we talk about in the men's sport now. We're talking about, is this player too braggadocious? Should there be more sportsmanship on this level? Who's the GOAT? Wait, this person follows this politician? Wait, they have beef? Guys, gals, sports fans, it has happened. It has happened. It is now just one of the sports. And that is the greatest testament to the hard work done by the women, the people that led the way in women's college basketball all the way from the 70s and 80s to right now, that it is now that conversation. We're not talking about, oh, the reason why women's college basketball is great because of fundamentals. You know, using those keywords that people would like to use to say the thing that they don't want to say, if you catch my drift. That's not the case anymore. We can have opinions about what it meant yesterday for Black America who watch college basketball, or white America that watch college basketball, seeing LSU versus Iowa, Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese being representative of that. We can talk about the future of the sport, how legitimate it is to see it grow, TV deals, the popularity of the WNBA, the markets that are winning in the WNBA, the stars and the NIL that is happening right now in women's college basketball, the ratings that are killing right now for women's college basketball. We can talk about that. And all that is conversation that, rightfully so, is just sports conversation finally being done for this sport. And I think that is something that I just find awesome, because I'm willing to talk about Kim Mulkey in all the different ways you would like to. I'm willing to talk about Angel Reese and her representation and what she has to go through on a day-to-day basis, whether it is misogyny, whether it is racism, whether it is being sexually objectified. I could talk about all the pressure that happens to Caitlin Clark and all the other great players, like we just mentioned Juju over at USC and some of the other ballers around the country that don't get the recognition or are undermined. I'm willing to talk about that, but that's sports conversation now. That's next level. That's not condescending sports talk that used to be done for women's college basketball. It is now a major sport. I don't need to be the one that tells you that. But if I realize it, if I see it, if it's there, then I think it's something we can't ignore, because it is only going to get bigger. And as long as these athletes keep to that level that they're playing in right now, that they're showcasing, I think there's a great chance that this growth is going to be next level. And we have just seen the tip of the spear of some of the greats that we might be seeing over the next decade plus. And I also want to give a quick shout out, because obviously that matchup between Iowa and LSU, done by the bracket committee to make sure we did get that matchup, shout out to them because they lived up to the hype. Now we have a great Final Four. You know, like, you have Iowa versus UConn, NC State versus South Carolina. South Carolina, monsters. Filthy team. I love their head coach as well. They have a great chance of just winning this whole thing, just stomping through. But what if NC State, who has a men and women's team in the Final Four, just like UConn this year, first time that's ever happened. What a great story that would be for them. First time in the Final Four, at least I think since in the 1970s, I'm not 100% sure, but NC State making a run, that's awesome. And obviously UConn. Remember when it would seem impossible that UConn would ever lose a national championship? When you think about how far the sport has come from it only being Tennessee and UConn to where they're at now, I mean, and Paige Buchers, like, there's stars everywhere. There's stars everywhere. And it just is the testament that, man, shout out to them, because they've hit it big time. And it's going to be an awesome Final Four. It's been an awesome tournament on both sides of the sport. This has been a lot of fun. I cannot wait to see this continue on. To see Angel Reese, I think, has one more year of eligibility at LSU. But we know Caitlin Clark is going to be heading to WNBA, to the Indiana Fever. So kind of state that, you know, Iowa clinged on to her. Indiana is going to do the exact same thing. Halliburton and Clark are going to be stars in Indianapolis. But it was a great matchup. It lived up to the hype. So many things to break down. This is just fodder when it comes to new story after new story after new story. And that is just a testament to how important and big time this was and how big time the sport is getting in women's college basketball, women's basketball in general. But we want to know your thoughts. An awesome matchup between the Iowa Hawkeyes and the LSU Tigers. This time, for the final time, Caitlin Clark gets her revenge, heading now to the Final Four as Iowa beat LSU. What are your thoughts about Kim Mulkey? There'll be times we talk about her. She's put herself on the spotlight now, so we'll be dissecting and talking about how her adventure now moves on with LSU, and will that include an Angel Reese and the rest of that awesome roster that we know they're going to be around for a long time. So I also want to give a shout out to, I always forget how to say her first name, but shout out to Johnson. Dropped 23 points, 37 minutes. She should have been on Caitlin Clark, but that's a conversation for a different day. Again, we'll have on an expert here on the Sports Cubicle who's been covering the sport, who could really break down the significance of what this Women's March Madness really meant for the sport. But we got a whole lot left here on the Sports Cubicle. Let us know your thoughts. What do you think about Kim Mulkey? What do you think about LSU? What are your thoughts on Caitlin Clark? Will she finish her story? We got a lot left here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado. They're playing basketball. We love that
is my favorite sport. I like the way the dribble up and down the court, just like
I'm the king rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado, and I'm here with the one, the only, the man, the myth, the legend. I am here with the marvelous one, Dan Marver. Marver, it has been way too long, and I am so excited because today we get to hype up, we get to break down, we get to review, we get to talk about the road taken to the men's national championship game between the Purdue Boilermakers and the UConn Huskies. Marver, before we get to the actual game itself, I know you are somebody who not only covers what was going on in the big tournament, in the NCAA men's tournament and women's tournament, you've been keeping an eye on the NIT, you've been keeping an eye on in what happened for the U of I women's team, we'll get into a little bit later on today, but your thoughts about the road to the Final Four and now the destination, the number one seeds, the huge matchup between Purdue and UConn. Can Zach Edey finish the destiny of his manifestation coming true? What do you think, Marver, about this road taken?
Now, it's very rare that you have the two best teams playing in the finals because there's always an upset. Anything can happen in 40 minutes with college kids, you know. So this is quite unusual. And you're actually going to have Edey with an opportunity to finish his career with a championship at Purdue. And, you know, they were in the final. They haven't been in the NCAA championships since 1969. And a funny thing, Grant Hill said, none of these kids were born then. Well, guess what? None of their parents were born then. That would have been a better line because it was 55 years ago. Anyway, unless they had kids in their 40s, but whatever. Be that as it may. So, I mean, 1969, that was a great game too, by the way. Rick Mount, who most people from Indiana remember, 33-point average for Purdue. They lost to Lou Alcindor, who was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, in the finals in 69. And that was the last time they were in the finals. And a little thing about Rick Mount, 33 points, there was no three-point line. And he was beaten out for the player of the year by two people, Pete Maravich and Lou Alcindor. So there were quite a few big names back then. In any event, now this group here, I mean Connecticut was rolling through the tournament. They beat everybody by double digits, and they'll be quite difficult to handle. The key to Purdue has been the supporting cast. Pedestrian names like Smith and Jones have stepped up, as well as Lawyer. And I happened to run into the family in Indianapolis of the Lawyers, and their jersey said, they wear a shirt that says Lawyer Up. Because he has a brother that was in the played at Michigan State and Davidson, and I happened to run into them last year. But in any event, they need supporting cast. They need the bench players to contribute because this is going to be a real match of the people besides the big guys, because Connecticut has a big guy of their own. But the difference there is that he doesn't seem to have stamina, and he can't play the 40 minutes that Edey plays. So that's going to be an interesting sidebar to the game. But finally, we get a game that's really worth the hype because you've got, obviously, arguably the two best teams all year long in Connecticut and Purdue. And it's come down to this game on Monday night. So I look forward to it. It should be great. And, you know, it's a whole new era yet with Ian Eagle on the mic instead of Nance. And it was funny. For most of the game, I thought that perhaps Raftery was thinking he was still working with Vern Lundquist because he kept calling Eagle. It sounded like Vern, but he's calling him Bird.
Yeah.
I thought he was like having dementia, and he thought he was with Vern Lundquist again.
No, but it was. I, you know what? And shout out to them. About time we didn't get a chance to really talk about this, but to Bird, Ian Eagle, you know, big shoes to fill. But I think in a world where we've seen a lot of new faces in play by play and in big spots, I think he stepped up, and we've known he's a quality announcer to begin with. So continue, Marvelous.
Right, and then so the big match with Donovan Klingon is the big 7-footer for Connecticut. So that's going to be, you know, something you don't see very often in the finals. It goes back to the old days, you know, thinking of Lou Alcindor with Elvin Hayes or somebody, you know, where the two big centers are featured. And again, it will be completely about the supporting cast, in my opinion, as to how well they shoot from the outside. Because in general, Connecticut has a better shooting percentage as a team than Purdue, but during the tournament, Purdue has done much better if they can hit some threes that will either team that will bring the defense out, and the double teams that they'll have to send down in the paint will allow some openings, and both the centers are terrific passers too. So it should be an outstanding game all the way around.
Does it surprise you that at the end of this entire tournament, where there is always those variables and those randomness that happens, that it not only is two number one seeds we've seen before, and, you know, even the years where things get wacky, but it's not just the two number one seeds. It's the for sure two number one seeds. People had all their money riding on these two teams on the different sides of the bracket. How impactful do you think not only is it that chalk did win out, but it's two fan bases with players that are pretty exciting during a time where you could kind of siphon off and live off some of that shine that's coming from the women's side and try to capitalize on that? How important do you think it is that we did get a UConn-Purdue matchup in the men's side of the bracket specifically?
Yeah, you're right. You do make a good point, because some of the spotlight has been taken over by that great Iowa-South Carolina game that was played today.
Yeah, and you know what? Before we, Marvin, we'll get into what is going to happen in that game, because as of this recording, we are breaking down the men's side of the national championship. When you listen to this on the Sports Cubicle Sunday night, we will have crowned a women's champion, a new women's basketball champion between South Carolina and Iowa. And we may not be able to break down what happened in that game, but Marvin and I are going to take a second in just a little bit to talk about that awesome bracket that has been the women absolutely killing it on their side. But Marvin, you were saying with that the spotlight that has been Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, the entire South Carolina run, the entire tournament. Now you're in the men's side where you have these two number one seeds. How important is it for men's college basketball that this was the end game between these two teams?
I think it's going to be good for the ratings, you know, for one thing. And I think that, you know, it's interesting this year, you know, the championship is on TBS instead of CBS. So if anybody steals an antenna, they may be locked out. But I mean, I think that it's terrific. I mean, for example, for Connecticut, these other players such as Caravan and Spencer and Diarra are going to be so critical. And I mentioned the side players for Purdue. That's the whole key. Can they hit outside shots? Can they open things up? Because Connecticut, in every game they played, at one point they've had 7-0, 8-0 runs, and they go crazy. And most of it's from the outside when they do that. So that's going to be a key factor in the game. And you know, I look forward to it, and it's a perfect ending. I still would like them to change the format a little bit, because there's so many teams, and you look at, you know, you talk about the NIT, Indiana State and Seton Hall, the two black teams that weren't selected for the NCAA. That was another perfect scenario where the two best teams that did not make the NCAA played in the finals in the NIT. So that was a wonderful thing as well.
Shout out to Kareem Jewel Abdul-Jabbar over at Indiana State for Sycamores. Avila, he's a baller, and we got love for him. And like you said, there is room. I think the expansion talk we can maybe save for this coming up holiday season when we get closer to the next bracket, because you know that's going to be the next thing when we're living in this new expanded tournament for college football and for all these different sports. So that's definitely something we're going to mark on our calendars as we get closer to when that becomes an inevitability. But you mentioned UConn being a dominant team, and here on the Sports Cubicle, I'm your host, Mike Mercado. He's the Marvelous One, Dan Marver. We are breaking down and previewing the men's national championship game between the Purdue Boilermakers and the UConn Huskies. And before we get into the big stage moment, the big stage feel of what the women are going to do, and by the time you listen to this on the Sports Cubicle on the radio, we would have crowned the new champion. But before we get to that, I think here locally, there is a weird biasness in this game where it's 50-50. And I think this is where I want to get your prediction, because people who don't really watch a lot of college basketball, but around this time of year, they get really invested, whether it is just for the brackets, whether it's for gambling, just entertainment, because there's games on at 11 o'clock. If you go to the state of Illinois, you've seen games against Purdue. You saw the University of Illinois win the Big Ten tournament and make a run into the Sweet 16. So you have a certain idea of what Purdue might do. But then you see them get absolutely demolished by UConn in this same tournament. And now it's a matchup between Purdue and UConn. So I think people here locally in Chicago, the state of Illinois, the Midwest, have a weird kind of biasness or maybe an uncertainty of how to predict this game. I think a lot of people with their hearts are going to pick Purdue. I think a lot of people who are cynical or clinical or very much just trying to be neutral are going to pick UConn. So with that in mind, who are you going with? And do you kind of understand the mindset of the fan base going into this national championship game locally?
Yeah. Well, I actually pick UConn all the way along. And I, you know, after last year's fairly Dickinson debacle for Purdue, I thought that they might stumble, you know, because they did have that first round loss to a 16 seed last year, and which was remarkable. It almost seemed impossible that could have happened, but it did. And they, you know, give them credit. They didn't stumble this year. And I just think that Connecticut has a little bit too much besides the centers. Edie will, you know, will obviously do his thing, but I think Connecticut has too much firepower, and they've been, you know, they've been battle tested a little bit more, I think, than Purdue, honestly. And I think they're gonna win that game in Phoenix.
I agree. I think UConn wins 72-65. They go back to back. I had them beating Houston in the beginning of this tournament. So now that we're here, I think UConn, like you said, is just too much. Shout out to for Purdue for having such a great run. And this is one of those moments where everybody can remember where they were at if you're a Purdue fan. There's something great about a tournament run and a redemption story. Whether or not they win the whole thing, the redemption has happened. They've made it to the national championship game. And I think that's really cool for Purdue. And speaking of Phoenix, you are in Phoenix right now. So you are there where it's the hottest as we were crowned a national champion. But Marver, as we get ready to crown a men's national champion, by the time you listen to this audio here on the Sports Cubicle with the Marvelous One, Dan Marver, I'm Mike Mercado. We will have a new women's champion in the game. It will either be South Carolina or Iowa. You know, I love this matchup. You know, I think there's something really cool about the Caitlin Clark story. If you take away all the noise of, you know, the Angel Reese drama and the, because here's the thing, Marvin, and I only want to spend a second on this because we've already done a whole segment about this particular, but all the stories that are legitimate off the court, the things that get people talking, the things that are news related, social related, are all true. But now that we're at a game now where it's just a basketball game, four quarters, somebody gets to win a national champion, somebody gets to solidify their legacy. And at this point right now, I think you have Dawn Staley on the other side for South Carolina, who's going to make a great matchup against Caitlin Clark. And Caitlin Clark, this is her moment. She beat and her team and their redemption story of getting through LSU, getting to the national championship in this season where you've broken all these records and you have the establishment, but not the establishment in a way where it's like Darth Vader. People like South Carolina. South Carolina is a likable team with likable coaches, and they have that good vibe opposed to, like, let's say LSU, which there was a lot of weird tension going on there. Yeah. So here we are. I think regardless of how it plays out, basketball won. And I also am a realist. I understand it's star driven. So next season may not be the exact same way, but for right now, this moment, It's the biggest talk in sports. Your thoughts of what the women did this past tournament?
I actually would like to mention Caitlin Clark, outstanding. Pete Maravich's all-time record, even though, you know, Pete only played 3 years and had no three-point line, but whatever. She's, you know, she's partnered with 11 companies at least, including Gatorade, Nike, and State Farm. She had an estimated NIL valuation of just under $1 million before she broke Maravich's record. It's now skyrocketed to $3.1 million after making more history. She's actually Angel Reese was ahead of her before she got some more endorsements. And so that, and she's never, you know, the young woman has never had a job. And so, you know, this NIL thing, I've done some research into it, and it's just pretty amazing that the athletes can now use their name, image, and likeness. And in her case, it's amounted to over $3 million. And, you know, God bless her. In terms of, you look at it, I told my daughter, for example, who's a girls basketball coach, this is going to be great for you because you're going to get more girls interested in basketball. You know, you're going to probably have like 20 more girls trying out. So I think that this is going to be a boom all the way down the line, you know, for girls, young girls, women in terms of basketball, because, you know, this has really put a spotlight on it. So no matter what happened in the game, I think that it's on ABC, you know, it's not on cable, which is funny because the men's game is on cable and the women's game isn't this
Bingo.
Week. Yeah. So that tells you something right there.
And I think that that's just it. Right. And we mentioned it last week. It has now become mainstream because basketball is so universal, not just for what country you play at, not just for whatever your financial economic situation may be. It's also very much inclusive for gender. Anybody can become a sharpshooter. Anybody can have awesome lockdown defense. Anybody can get themselves to be a master at dribbling with handles and being able to see the court and run fast and be athletic. And that is what you're seeing right now. And I think this is the best of all worlds, Marvin, where there's so much gray and so much bad when it comes to the nastiness of people taking advantage of these student athletes with NIL deals in some situations. And then some situations where you see these superstars who have elevated everybody kind of get rewarded before they make that next step into their professional life. And I think that's what's been great. So shout out to the women. Shout out to that awesome national championship game that we are going to get to, an awesome Final Four, to an awesome tournament on the women's side. And shout out to the dudes. The dudes did it as well. It was great. This has been an awesome tournament, even though the basketball may not always be the most top tier. It is always fun to watch intense basketball. And speaking of basketball, Marver, last thing on the docket, we only got a few minutes on it, but you know what? They deserve it. The University of Illinois women's Fighting Illini team won the inaugural. Yeah. Yes, that's right there. The first ones ever win the inaugural women's basketball invitation tournament with a 71-57 victory over Villanova at Hinckley Fieldhouse in Indianapolis. And the first time the program has won a championship like that. And the men's side still waiting for the big one, their big moment to win a men's national championship. But pretty cool story, Marver.
Yeah, it is. It's great that the ones that don't make the big tournament get a chance to keep playing. And there's another side to that, too. I mean, a lot of teams don't decide to keep playing, you know, when they're snubbed. And it's great when a team does get that opportunity to go into a side tournament and go all the way. And props to Illinois women for that. Hats off to them. And it's a real Wild West going out there in college with the portal and the NIL and everything else, you know, and the extra COVID year. I don't know how many more years they're going to say the kids played during the COVID year. Is it going to be the year 2050 and they'll give them the fifth year still? It's crazy. It's crazy out there.
We'll find out, Marver. And I know this is something that you and myself and the boys here on the Sports Cube Go have talked about, the good and bad of NIL, and we want to make an honest kind of segment about it. And I think that's something we're working on behind the scenes. So that's something, if you're a college sports fan, if you're excited about, keep your eyes and ears to the Sports Cubicle, because we do have some stuff coming up the pipeline to kind of break down, now that this is part of regular sports, what NIL means, now that we have big time tournaments and big time players for not just the men, but for the women's side. We have this expansion going on in the football side, all these different collegiate things going on with these super conferences. Yeah. We're going to be here to make sure we break it all down. Marver, final thoughts, my friend?
I'll tell you what, in my a man on the street job, I ask people don't even know what NIL means or stands for. I'm the average person. And their people come up to me and say, oh, how about that Caitlin Clark? And it's like they've discovered her, but she beat the freshman scoring record 3 years ago. So she's not actually a new news item, but just spotlight's been put on her. Is it talent or is it because she was back behind the barn shooting 53 pointers a day, in a row? I mean, it's a question for me as to how you develop that Stephen Curry-like skill to shoot 3-pointers from the logo. It's just, it's uncanny. It was funny because the announcers in the semifinals, she's unbelievable. She's possessed. It was like they couldn't come up with enough adjectives as she kept hitting the 3-pointers, which actually broke a record in that particular game. So, it's just craziness out there.
So, Marver, I'll leave you with this and the rest of our amazing friends here at the Sports Cubicle. What Victor Wembanyama is doing for the NBA and Caitlin Clark is doing for women's basketball is
Yeah.
just the beginning. The Super Freak 7'3" point guard is coming, and the Super Freak athletic could shoot from anywhere in the gym athlete is coming for both sports, because you have 7, 8, 9 year olds now who are replicating. And which one is easier to replicate? Which one is easier to think you can do? That's why Steph Curry is considered more than LeBron, more than Michael, more than a lot of these guys, institutionally changed the way the game is played. And that is why it's so fascinating. That's why we love it here on the Sports Cubicle, to really break down the nitty-gritty of one of our favorite sports. But Marver, that is it. The only thing left to do is to wait for that one shining moment for tip-off to happen, and we get to crown two new champions and one scenario, a potential repeat champion defending their crown. Will it be UConn? Will it be Purdue? Will it be Iowa? Will it be South Carolina? You let us know your thoughts down in the comment section below, or wherever you get your favorite podcast, or on Twitter at SportsCubicleTV. Enjoy all the games. He's the marvelous one, Dan Marver. I'm Mike Mercado. We got more coming up next year on the Sports Cubicle. We keep things rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado, and a huge trade happened in the NFL, and it is something I think all Bears fans are going to be talking about, because it really puts a light on some philosophy that is the true economics in the NFL, and that is the huge trade that happened between the Buffalo Bills and the Houston Texans, as the Bills traded four-time Pro Bowl wide receiver Steph Diggs to the Houston Texans for draft pick compensation. Exactly, the trade is the Bills received a 2025 second-round pick. That's from the Minnesota Vikings that the Houston Texans got in exchange for Diggs as well. A 2024 sixth-round pick, the number 189 overall, and the 2025 fifth-round selection. The Texans acquired the pick from the Vikings when they traded their 2024 first-round pick to the Minnesota Vikings last month. So I wanted to jump on and talk to you Bears fans specifically, and I think all NFL fans in general that are really, for the first time, looking at how GMs and these owners view and how they value certain contracts and certain ways of building rosters. So here in Chicago, over the last few months, and I would say throughout the entire past season, there was a huge conversation about whether or not the Bears should invest in Justin Fields, whether or not Justin Fields is the quarterback of the future for the Bears, whether or not it should be, if you ended up with the number one pick like they did, or in the top five via Carolina's pick, what you should do. Should you trade down for even more draft assets? Should you draft the quarterback? Well, current time, we saw how it all played out, and now Justin Fields is playing for Mike Tomlin and being the backup to Russell Wilson in the Pittsburgh Steelers. The NFL is crazy. And the Bears obviously got the number one pick via Carolina, have their own number nine pick in this year's draft as well. So two top 10 picks, the number one, the most important, and consensus seems to be Caleb Williams. All the discussion, this isn't a Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Drake May, J.J. McCarthy, Bo Nix, Michael Penix conversation anymore. We all have our opinions of who you think they should get. Who do you want them to get? What do you think is going to happen? What trades are going to happen? I think regardless, we know the Chicago Bears are obviously drafting a quarterback, whatever they select. I believe it's Caleb Williams at number one. But using whoever you think it's gonna be, this is what the NFL is now. Steph Diggs is only going to the Houston Texans because of two quarterback situations for two organizations that are completely different. The Buffalo Bills are paying Josh Allen, who is a good, great, whatever you want to say quarterback. Steph Diggs is an elite wide receiver. So you have to decide in your own mind, how much did Steph make Josh Allen and how much did Josh Allen make Steph Diggs? That's up to you. That's up to you to value that personally. But the NFL values quarterback play. They value the quarterback. We know that. So they pay Josh Allen. And when you pay a quarterback, it affects the rest of your team. All the different players that really impact you winning a Super Bowl. Yeah, the quarterback is the most important position in probably all of sports. But it doesn't change the fact that you need a team to win. So when you put yourself in that position, and if he's not him, if it's not Patrick Mahomes, who really might be the only guy who could do this, that can carry you to a Super Bowl when you just have just enough of a roster around them, it's hard to win a Super Bowl after you've paid your quarterback. It's hard to keep a great roster around your quarterback that can win Super Bowls after you've paid him. The Bears found themselves in that situation with Justin Fields. I think we all could agree we all love the kid, and we all love seeing him do some special things on the field. But economically speaking, the Bears were in a position where they had enough confidence in their defense. They just brought in this super stud in Montez Sweat, gave him money. They've now given Jalen Johnson money. They feel they're in that 4 or 5 year window. You have DJ Moore, one of the elite wide receivers in the entire NFL. Oh, and now you've traded for Keenan Allen, one of the other elite wide receivers in the NFL. You've brought in DeAndre Swift. You have invested in that offensive line. And now you have a decision to make with the number one overall pick. And there is a consensus guy at that position, at quarterback. And now you're facing paying Justin Fields, a guy this regime didn't draft. A fifth-year option, and then a brand-new contract. If you believed wholeheartedly that Justin Fields was that dude, like, let's say, Ryan Poles or Kevin Warren, then they could justify paying Justin Fields. But they didn't. Because in the NFL, in order to build a really good team, you need a quarterback under a rookie deal. And then that is the window to strike, and that is what's happening right now. And you look at the Houston Texans, who now have a trio of Nico Collins, Tank Dell, and Steph Diggs with Joe Mixon and CJ Stroud at quarterback, who is what? Under a rookie deal, who took his team to the playoffs last year. If Justin Fields had balled out and made it almost impossible, there would have been an argument. There were so many different things that happened this past season that some was on his shoulders, some out of his hands. But it shows the value of having a rookie quarterback that can do that, that can take your team to the playoffs. And let's not forget, we know this in town, but something the national media has been learning, or national fans, I should say more specifically, the Bears aren't at number one because of their record. The Bears are at number nine because they won 7 games. So if the Bears believe that they're a team that minimum can win 7 games and you bring in a quarterback you believe who at number one can do something for you, yeah, economically speaking, is the most responsible thing to do. And if he is that guy, then it's going to cost you. That's the one thing that's inevitable, though. If you find your guy at quarterback, you're going to have to pay him at some point. And the Bears finally found their dude at QB, they better hope to try to win the Super Bowl within that rookie deal, to be contenders in that rookie deal, win divisions in that rookie deal. Otherwise, when they feel that they're going to be in contention in his prime after this rookie deal, it's going to cost them a heck of a lot of money at one position specifically. But Steph Diggs heading to the Buffalo Bills, something that the NFL, the world is shook in the NFL, and it is going to be an interesting season in the AFC South. That team is going to be a darling heading into next year. But let us know your thoughts of this huge trade as Steph Diggs now heads to the Houston Texans. We got more coming up next here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm Mike Mercado.
Cypress Creek, a tale of one city.
Let's watch up, Mouse.
Homer, you're trying to talk us into moving to this place.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Let's watch this.
Look at this place.
Somebody ought to build a town that works.
Somebody did.
called Cypress Creek, a planned community designed for the workers of the Globex Corporation. Cypress Creek, where dreams come true.
Your dreams may vary from those of Globex Corporation, its subsidiaries, and shareholders.
And we keep things rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado. He's the one, he's the only, he's Paul Shavari. And it has been a little while, Paulie, since we've taken a glance at what's going on in the West Coast, more specifically, what's going on with the Oakland Athletics. I know we've had a lot of conversation about new stadiums, relocation here locally, and it's great entertainment for sports fans. It's great for radio, podcasting, video, and all that. But this is now a really sad situation that's going on in Oakland, Pauly, and I want to bring it up. This comes to us from Yahoo. A's reach deal to play in Sacramento while waiting for Las Vegas Stadium. The Oakland Athletics are headed to Las Vegas by way of Sacramento. The team has reached an agreement with the Sacramento Kings, owner of the AAA Sacramento Rivercats, to play in their stadium from 2024 to 2027, while their Vegas Stadium is being built, with an option to extend their stay to 2028. The A's will move to Sutter Health Park once their lease in Oakland runs out at the end of the 2024 season. Quote, "We look forward to making Sutter Health Park our home through our move to Las Vegas," said A's owner and managing partner John Fisher. Quote, "We extend our appreciation to the Kings and the city of West Sacramento for hosting the A's while we work to complete our new ballpark in Las Vegas." Notably, the statement only identifies the team involved as the A's, indicating they will go without a city in their name until their next destination. The deal solves one of the significant remaining questions for the A's as they prepare to pull up roots from Oakland and head to Las Vegas, where the team has plans to build a 33,000-seat stadium on the site of the recently closed Tropicana Las Vegas Hotel. Oakland reportedly offered to bridge the gap with a five-year lease extension earlier this week, though that came with demands, including a $97 million extension fee and requirements that MLB facilitate the sale of the A's to a local ownership group. Let Oakland keep the team names and colors, or give Oakland a one-year exclusive right to solicit ownership of a future expansion team. And lastly, I wanted to make sure we hit this note. The AAA Rivercats play at Sutter Health Park, which holds a capacity of 14,014 people, which is smaller than MLB's smallest stadium, the Tampa Bay Rays Tropicana Field, by more than 10,000 seats. And again, I suggest everybody check out that entire article over at Yahoo. A's reach a deal to play in Sacramento while waiting for Las Vegas Stadium. So, Paulie, you got into details about this, and this is something you have talked about for a long time. I'm really saddened about this. You know, obviously, neither one of us are A's fans. My only connection with the A's is Dave Otto, and that my high school jerseys were replicated of the Oakland A's. But, you know, to me, it's just another one of these things where a sports fandom is losing a team. They have great history, and it's going to an artificial fan base that they're going to have to create over there, and they're going to hope that tourism helps. But your thoughts of this crazy unprecedented deal where the Oakland A's are going to play in Sacramento, and they're now going to be called, just like Prince, the artist formerly known as the Oakland A's, the A's are moving to Sacramento. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it just shows how unprepared Major League Baseball was for all of this. But then again, I don't know how much, you know, sway Major League Baseball even has in that regard. I guess with it being in San Francisco, if you're an A's fan, it's not terribly far to get to Sacramento. It's about an hour and a half drive. So I guess there's still an element where you can go and see your team, you know, much like the San Diego Chargers fans can go up the highway to go see them in Los Angeles if they truly still wanted to be fans. It's sad because, you know, you and I only know the A's as being a team from Oakland, but Las Vegas will be the fourth city, or fifth if you count Sacramento, fifth city in their franchise's history. Sacramento at least has a major league team in basketball, so it's not like it's a totally, I mean, I know that's a little different, but
yeah.
But at least, you know, it's not like completely out of nowhere. It's still relatively close to the Bay Area. It gives a chance, but I think, you know, it's done. The A's are no longer going to play in Oakland. They're no longer going to play in the Bay Area. It's more or less official that they're going to go to Las Vegas. It's been approved by the owners. They have the site. You know, they already now have a plan what they're going to do in the meantime. Now it's just a matter of what happens to the Oakland Coliseum. I mean, I guess that's going to be residential or industrial area in Oakland. That's, you know, the city's problem and not sports problem. But I think Major League Baseball, you know, they're very keen on wanting better markets and more lucrative markets. And I understand that Oakland just was kind of a dead horse at this point. But what did the league do to try and facilitate this? You know, what help did the league give the A's to try and either help themselves in Oakland or help themselves in Las Vegas? And then are they going to do this to other teams? You know, the A's are a shining example to me of what will happen to the White Sox, because the fans aren't going, so you could easily see there's another team in the area. It's crazy how similar the Coliseum and Guaranteed Rate are in terms of kind of where it's located and how to get there. You know, next to a highway, next to transportation, over the highway. It's weird. It gave me vibes when I walked into the Oakland Coliseum. It gave me Guaranteed Rate Field vibes as I was walking in there. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's just, you know, we're kind of waiting with bated breath here in Chicago to see what will happen to the White Sox based on what happens here. But I think when it's all said and done, it's probably right for Major League Baseball to have a team in Las Vegas. The A's were ripe for the picking. Now it's just going to be that weird awkwardness in Sacramento, but it's kind of like when the Blue Jays during the pandemic season had to play in Buffalo.
Right.
Kind of gives me those vibes.
Sure.
And denied in Florida, you know? So, yeah, it's going to be weird for a few seasons, but at the same time, it's not like we haven't really seen this before.
So the thing that's most disheartening for me is billionaires who've owned clubs from any league, all the way from the EPL to the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, NHL, all that stuff, right? WNBA. They owned it to be the cool guy in the billionaire clubhouse. Man or woman, and say, I own the so-and-so team in the NBA. That was the goal. Nowadays, these billionaires don't care in their portfolio that they're the cool person in the club that owns a professional team. They want to own the real estate in which a major team plays in. And that to me is so disheartening because you can fake competitiveness. When you say, I want to be the coolest guy at the party, I want to be Mark Cuban, I want to be one of the Steinbrenners, it doesn't matter, right? I want to be Alex Rodriguez trying to buy the Minnesota Timberwolves because I want to be in that club. There's a reason why athletes want to join that club. That is, to me, the saddest part about this. I can understand business and wanting to build new stadiums and all that. It just seems to me the disingenuousness or the straight capitalist evilness that has infiltrated sports where it is now a real estate business.
But examine that for a minute. What would be the benefit of staying in Oakland?
I don't necessarily know if there is a benefit of staying in Oakland.
I don't think there is.
I think this is an example. The easiest road is the Oakland Athletics to take them out of Oakland right for the pickings. But I start thinking about the White Sox and I start thinking about how somebody, a new ownership group, would rather a brand new multi-billion dollar complex in any city, sure, Southside if you want, that'd be great, but we'll take Nashville, we'll take Charlotte, because it meant you own a whole lot of land with a big billion-dollar stadium on top of it that the team so happens to play in. That to me is such a sad thing in sports nowadays, and I think Oakland was so defenseless. The fan base was defenseless, and the organization itself, not the ownership, the A's logo, the property, the IP, was vulnerable to being picked up and used as a pawn to build a brand new stadium in Las Vegas. To me, that's what it is. It could have been anybody. It just so happened to be the Oakland Athletics.
Yeah, just kind of following Oakland's politics a little bit when this was happening with the Raiders, the city doesn't have enough resources, yeah. Nor does the county to really attract this. And yeah. I mean, Oakland, Alameda County, you know, the city of Oakland and Alameda County, California own the stadium that they play in, the A's and the Raiders up until, you know, 2019. And I mean, it's a dump, you know, it's the last dual use stadium. It's built below sea level, you know, constant problems. One of the older ballparks, I think right now it's the fourth oldest ballpark in Major League Baseball. So, I mean, it needed an upgrade. It needed a way out. There's just nowhere else in Oakland that, you know, they could have done it. Jack London Square, they talked about it, the waterfront stadium. It would have worked out maybe, but it's just, were you going to attract the people there? Would that have made things better? I mean, there would have been, you know, the honeymoon effect that right. Andrew Zimbalist talks about, where for the first couple of years, you might have people going. So it's new and it's fun. But then I think it would revert back to A's attendance totals. And before you go and talk about how like A's fans show up, go back to like 2002, 2003. They weren't really selling out that stadium during that run that they were going on every single season. And it's just, you know, it's like the Cubs White Sox effect in town. There's already a team in San Francisco that's doing way better. Most of the fans are probably Giants fans. And then because the Giants own so much of the Bay Area in terms of placement of a stadium, you're limited to pretty much Oakland or Berkeley to build.
The elephant in the room is San Francisco. You have that beautiful baseball stadium and Golden State Warriors, who were proud to play in Oracle in Oakland, moved to San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's like they have shown you what they want to do. And it's kind of what we talk about, Jerry, the dog whistling. Don't tell me why you want to move to the 78th. We know why you want to move to the 78th from Bridgeview. Mm-hmm. So now that you brought it to the forefront, like the some similarities is pretty scary. But I think the difference between Oakland fans and White Sox fans is White Sox fans there is going to be a revolt, more than a revolt. Than like Oakland fans have been passionate and they've been protesting. But like you said, it might have been a dead brand in Oakland.
Well,
the White Sox could still succeed in Chicago.
They're both American League charter franchises, yeah. But one is going on their fourth or fifth city and the other one has been in the same neighborhood the entire time.
So we want to know your thoughts. I know this is always a difficult subject for fans, but I think in general, media members, journalists, fans, people from the outside, it's sad to see this because I don't know many other directions they could have found themselves out of this. And it's just sad that we're seeing an IP, a logo, something that's been so part of the institute, part of the foundation of the Oakland Athletics, even though, like you said, they've come from different cities for a whole generation plus. They're the Oakland A's, and now they're going to become the Las Vegas A's.
The majority of their time was spent in... I think Kansas City, Philadelphia to Kansas City was about as long, if not shorter, than Oakland, you know, sure. Or Kansas City to Oakland. Yeah.
And unlike the other Vegas teams that have succeeded, this isn't a expansion. This is a relocation.
But
The Raiders had the benefit, and like even though it's a different location, it's the Raiders had the benefit of the mesh of the Vegas culture to the Raider fan base and the vibes of the Raider organization. It was seamless.
Well, and the fewer amount of games for the Raiders, yeah. So that all of their opponents bring in their own built-in fan bases anyway, regardless of how big or small those fan bases are. Whereas this is going to be a little harder.
This is a tough
30,000 seats. Yes. You got to build, you know, like no one's really going to make the trek all the time from Oakland to Las Vegas to see the team. It's not going to be like a pilgrimage like you see with the Raiders.
100%.
You know, Athletics Nation is different than Raider Nation. And I don't know if it's going to be, you know, like, I don't think you're going to have a lot of the Yankees are going to Vegas. I guess we better all fly there for the series. You might have a little bit of that, but it's not going to be like the NFL where there's only 8 chances a year to go do that. There's going to be 81 chances a year to go see your team play in Las Vegas. And there's nothing in me that says I got to go see the White Sox out there. I mean, I'm sure there's Cubs people that would love to have a weekend in Vegas, but I don't think it's going to be a lot. So it's really going to, I mean, Las Vegas is its own little culture, its own little city. It's got enough people, but are they going to embrace baseball? And at the same time, it's not like it's not a baseball haven. You know, Chris Bryant, Greg Maddux, Bryce Harper, all of them from Las Vegas. So it's weird, you know, because it's like there is definitely a local baseball element, but will that transfer over to tickets sold? Because it's also, too, you know, the Raiders, it's not so much like, hey, let's attract people from the area to go see the team. It's a very tourist-based economy with Allegiant Stadium and what they attract to that ballpark. So, like, it's got to be the same with Tropicana and, you know, the stadium that they're going to build there. And I can't believe it's so few seats, only 30,000 seats.
So all that for a 30,000 seat
stadium.
But I
think they're going to overprice the tickets.
Yeah.
Have you seen the renderings? It's going to be a spectacle.
And they want to have Red Sox, Cubs, Yankees, Philly fans in April and May to come to Vegas when it's snowing in their home city. Well,
especially
and
that it's three
to
games, too. You could sell the package.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
three night, 4 day stay.
For sure.
Come see all three games that your team's playing.
But we'll be all over this story because while it's happening in the West Coast, we know Chicago is going to be in the spotlight with the stadium talk, relocation talk, negotiation talk, and we're going to be here to break it all down.
Well, that's going to do it for the Sports Cubicle. I want to thank you all for listening. For Devin Tingle, Mike Mercado, and the marvelous one, Dan Marver, I am Paul Shivari. So long, everybody. We will see you next week.